Hey, hello everybody, Danny Schechter, your news dissector, the special time of the year, special day. Let us remember. Recognize this song by now. It's a soulful version, Charlie Hayden, the Liberation Music Orchestra. The song, of course, We Shall Overcome, the song that defined a whole decade of protest and struggle, the song that we remember today sort of sheepishly almost because of our innocence, and we remember Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who died today. In Memphis, Tennessee, in 1968, shot down by an assassin's bullet. We still don't know exactly what happened there. There are many different theories. We'll get into some of them. But remembering Dr. King is what we're doing here today. We hope to be joined by Reverend Jesse Jackson, Jr., who was in Memphis on that day, and also with Rabbi Arthur Waskow, who's been preaching and teaching about Martin Luther King's prophetic meaning for America. And then later in the show, we'll be talking to a gentleman in Maine who's made it part of his life to analyze and study what happened in Memphis that day. And he's basically telling us it's not what we think. So stay with us. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector, here with Polarity One on News Dissector Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.com.
Once upon this planet Earth, lived a man of humble birth, preaching love and freedom for his fellow men. He was dreaming of the day peace would come to earth to stay, and he spread this message all across the land. Turn the other cheek, he'd plead. Love thy neighbor was his creed. Pain, humiliation, death, he did not dread.
One of the most beautiful songs of all time, Nina Simone's tribute to the Dreamer, to Dr. King, and it's a song we'll return to later on in this program. I wanted to introduce you to an old friend of mine, Rabbi Arthur Waskow from Philadelphia Shalom Center, who's been writing and living out the creed of Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. ever since his days in the Civil Rights Movement, which were also, in a way, my days as well. And Rabbi Waskow has been talking about how aspects of the Jewish prophetic tradition is really in sync with what Dr. King was talking about, the Rabbi Herschel who marched with Dr. King and the like. So welcome Rabbi Waskow to this program again on this day, April 4th, the anniversary of the assassination of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.
Shalom, Danny. It's really nice to reconnect with you this way.
Well, you know, we're always connected, my brother. We're always connected, but you are especially connected in your writing and in the politics you've chosen to pursue and your religious work with a message of Dr. King. Why is that? What is it about Martin Luther King that meant so much to you?
Well, there were two moments, I guess, that really deeply affected me, even beyond the one that many people experienced. I was at the Great March for Jobs and Freedom, which is coming up on its 50th anniversary this summer, the I Have a Dream speech. But there were two other moments that for me were much deeper. One was in 1964, the summer of 64 in Atlantic City at the Democratic National Convention.
I was there, Arthur, too.
Okay.
So if you misspeak, I will correct you, but go ahead.
Okay. So the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party was attempting to be recognized as the real Democratic Party of Mississippi. It was integrated. It was anti-racist. It was ready to support the Democratic Party's nominee, whereas the all-white, and not just accidentally all-white, elected by an all-white electorate with blacks kept out of the electorate from Mississippi, was the regular Democratic Party. And the Freedom Democrats came to try to persuade at least 11 members of the Credentials Committee to take a minority resolution recognizing the Freedom Democrats to the floor of the convention. Lyndon Johnson, president, was utterly committed to prevent that from happening. He was really frightened of a public floor fight on primetime television with Fannie Lou Hamer, the chair of the Freedom Party, speaking about why it should be recognized.
I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Sick and tired, that's
Mrs.
right.
Hamer said that day.
Right.
And
that's
Lyndon
right.
Johnson called a press conference in the White House to try to get the TV cameras off of Mrs. Hamer and onto himself in one of the many dirty tricks of our political life.
Right. He was also, it turned out, having the FBI wiretap the headquarters of the Freedom Party and of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which had done a great deal of the organizing work in Mississippi during that summer, the Freedom Summer of 1964. So, but of course, that we didn't discover until later. So the Freedom Party asked Dr. King to come, in effect, lobby one by one by one by one the members of the Credentials Committee who we thought might be persuaded to vote for the Freedom Party, even though the president was leaning very hard. Johnson was threatening that if the Freedom Party got seated, he would not allow Hubert Humphrey to be nominated for vice president. And the Northern liberals were just beside themselves. It was like the wet dream of their lives to have Hubert Humphrey nominated for vice president. The assumption was then that he would go on to become president. And so they were really scared. And some of them were really machine Democrats who didn't want to make trouble for any president, and their own president anyway. So it was an uphill struggle. And what the Freedom Party had in mind was that maybe Dr. King's prestige could actually change some votes. And I was there because it was a group of former legislative assistants who knew members of Congress, some of whom were actually on the Credentials Committee. I had worked for Robert Kastenmeier of Wisconsin, and he was very deeply involved, committed to the Freedom Party, despite the pressure from liberal Democrats, other liberal Democrats in Wisconsin. He was a really, really deeply progressive, if not radical, member of Congress, an extraordinary guy. So I was there, and one by one, these members came out. They came out because it was Dr. King. But what moved me most was this was not the charismatic King of the Great March. This was a hard-working, really hard-working Dr. King talking one by one with people who really didn't want to be convinced about, he was talking about what life was really like in Mississippi. It was 105 degrees in the unair-conditioned convention center in Atlantic City.
It sounds like the temperature in this studio right now. you know, Arthur,
he had a broken leg. Yeah. And he worked for hours and hours. I don't think I've ever seen any human being work as hard. And I was deeply moved that it was not charismatic, that it was
a great story, Arthur. And also a significant moment because the schism, if you will, at the Democratic Convention in 1964, the failure to recognize the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, the failure of the Democratic Party to really embrace the civil rights movement led to the, you know, uprisings in Chicago in 1968, and to the fight against the war, which Dr. King had embraced earlier in his famous speech at the Riverside Church. So Dr. King was really central to pushing a politics that the establishment, the power structure, however much they embrace him today and, you know, speak of the dreamer and I have a dream and all the rest of it, they opposed him in what his real agenda was back then.
One of the reasons April 4th is for me so profound a date in my own life calendar is that earlier speech, the one at Riverside Church that you just mentioned, was on April the 4th, 67, exactly a year before Dr. King was killed. I was told recently by somebody who was sitting next to Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel on that day, this was a meeting of clergy and laymen, that was its name then, clergy and laymen concerned about Vietnam, and Heschel, Rabbi Heschel, one of King's close friends and co-workers, was co-chair of CALCAV, it was called, Clergy and Laity Concerned About Vietnam. And I just got a note a couple weeks ago saying that one rabbi who wrote me said he had leaned over to Dr. Heschel as he listened to the profound radicalism going to the root, that's what radical really means, going to the root of the dangers facing American society, leaned over to Heschel and said, Dr. King just signed his death warrant. And in fact, 1 year later, he was killed. And probably that had to do with his movement, his growth into a profoundly radical critic.
And, you know, not just
American
a civil rights leader, but a human rights leader.
That's right.
Somebody who is calling for a new foreign policy for our country. And he took a great risk in doing it. Many of the black leadership of the day, NAACP, Urban League, opposed his taking that stand. Lyndon Johnson certainly opposed it. The U.S. government was terrified, if you will, you know, that black Americans would abandon, you know, the foreign policy goals, the Vietnam War and the like. And, you know, this was at a time also, if you remember, Stokely Carmichael was in SNCC and he was saying, no Viet Cong ever called me nigger. This was a great movement of awakening that was going on in our country. Unfortunately, it's a little premature. I mean, today, there's nobody's going to really defend that Vietnam War except diehards.
Well, that's because of the opposition 50 years ago, 40 years ago, because we made clear how disastrous, and Dr. King, in that great speech at Riverside, which he called Beyond Vietnam, in which he took on the Vietnam War, but he also took on the deeper diseases, you might say. He talked about the disastrous triplets of militarism, racism, and materialism. And he said, if they're not dealt with now, a generation from now, there's going to have to be clergy and laity concerned about, and he named half a dozen other countries. It didn't occur to him to say Iraq, but he just might have, or Afghanistan, and he just might have. But he was right. We didn't go far enough. Killing him certainly made it harder to go far enough. He was in the midst. There were two things he was doing when he was killed. One, he was in Memphis defending the organizing of the garbage workers union. These were like the most outsider folk in America. They were black, they were poor, and what's more, since they were garbage men, they were smelly. And they were pariahs, and they were treated like pariahs by official Memphis.
This is where race, myth, class, if you will. This is where Dr. King became a champion of working people. And just the other day, I looked at an item where a reunion of some of the garbage men of Memphis took place. And they were talking about how the city of Memphis is trying to outsource garbage collection away from their union, away from the local workers to get a cheaper rate through some corporate connection, you know, outsourcing and the like. And so, you know, these issues, you know, are still with us all these years later, aren't they?
Well, the other thing that King was doing at that very moment was beginning the planning for what became the Poor People's Campaign, where the whole idea was that poor people of every color and every culture could come together to demand some profound changes in American society, to make a real transformation so that poverty would be ended.
Well,
and I think that was the deep reason why he was vulnerable to being assassinated.
Well, you know, you remember back in those days, we spoke of an alliance, if you will, between many different people and black Americans, including Jews who supported the civil rights movement in large numbers.
Right.
And Dr. King was comfortable with that and connected to a lot of those people. And then as the politics of the Middle East intruded in the United States, the Six-Day War and all the rest of it, there became a polarization. And I wonder if you can look at where that relationship is today and what you see happening in terms of the Jewish community, which you know very well as a rabbi and as an advocate, if you will, of more transcendent Judaism, more prophetic Judaism. You know, as terms of the legacy of the civil rights movement, are we moving backwards or are we still moving forwards?
Danny, if we have enough time, and I think we do, before we do that, I really would like to talk about the second moment in which Dr. King became absolutely deeply intertwined with my kishkas, with my guts,
okay,
as well as with my heart and my head.
You can't deny a rabbi's right to speak about his kishkas. That's for sure.
Right,
okay.
Right.
So, by the way, our number here, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. We're waiting for Jesse Jackson, but we could be waiting forever. So please continue, Rabbi.
Okay. All right. So that moment was the moment after his death. The next day, as I'm sure you remember, there were uprisings in black communities all over the country. I was living in the heart of Washington, and there was a black uprising in Washington. President Johnson sent the army to occupy the city. I don't know how many Americans remember that less than 50 years ago, the capital city of the United States was occupied. And I really do mean occupied, taking over the schools, taking over the traffic circles to control in every direction, what went where and what didn't. The army was totally present. A soldier with a rifle stood on the steps of the United States Capitol, and the president imposed a curfew on people of the District of Columbia. But it turned out the cops didn't care if whites were on the streets. There were about 10,000 blacks who were arrested, with the only charge being that they were on the streets, they were violating the curfew. They weren't accused of anything else. But the cops ignored white people. And so those of us who had been involved and who were white in the anti-war movement or the civil rights movement put together a network to get food, medical supplies, doctors, lawyers into the black community, which otherwise was totally cut off by the curfew. And that's what I was doing for a week. And then came the first night of Passover. At that point in my life, the only relationship I had with Jewish practice was the Passover Seder. It was about freedom. That was a good thing. It was serious in the family I grew up in, and that was a good thing. But I was not involved in any other aspect of Jewish life or practice. I was casually Jewish, and if somebody had pushed me, I might have said that my social activism had some connection with my grandparents and my parents' Jewishness, but not me. But that meant going home to do the Seder, the one thing that was still alive for me in the tradition. And going home to do the Seder meant going home past the United States Army with a Jeep with a machine gun pointed at the block I lived on. And to go back to my kishkas, my guts began to say, more than my brain, this is Pharaoh's army, and I'm going home to celebrate the liberation from Pharaoh and his army in the Passover Seder. And at that moment, the Seder wasn't just serious for me. It was like explosive, like
so
volcanic.
That's an epiphany moment, certainly.
Exactly.
Dayenu, dayenu. You know, I mean, this is definitely a moment when You know, you don't forget this. And that war has a way of coming home, as we know.
Yeah.
It comes home when the soldiers come back and they don't get adequate medical care or they're traumatized, post-traumatic stress disorder. But it comes home every day because it also is the diversion of so much money from the domestic economy, trillions of dollars, you know, being
right.
buried in the deserts of Iraq or
right.
the mountains of Afghanistan. And so we know how counterproductive that
right.
is.
And that was one of the points Dr. King made in the Riverside speech about Vietnam. But we've played it all over again as if there was total amnesia, played it all over again in regard to Iraq and Afghanistan. So the result for me was that the Seder came alive with such intensity that I was going to say captured by it, but you might say I was uncaptured by it. I was freed by it, which is what the Seder is supposed to do. And during the next year, I ended up writing a radical version of the Haggadah, service for the Seder, in which there was still, as always, the history or the story, anyway, whether it's history or not, the story of the ancient liberation from Pharaoh intertwined with modern liberation, especially the struggle of the black community in the United States against racism for the last couple hundred years.
Well, Pilar Levine is in the studio and can't talk too much, but can you relate to what Rabbi Waskow is talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. it's an interesting thing, you know. I relate to both sides of your Jewishness. The part when you didn't feel connected, and then the part when you felt so connected. I mean, I actually identify with being Jewish more than anything else.
Uh-huh.
Although there's nothing religious attached to it.
Uh-huh.
I feel just as you did, that political connection and the people from our past whose DNA that we share, the investment in struggle for dignity. You know, my grandparents
right.
came from Estetta
right,
in
exactly.
Lithuania.
Exactly.
So I got to tell you, the gentleman, on the way here, it was 4:36 in New York City, and I was on the east side at the studios of RT trying to get over here in time for the radio show, and I persuaded this cab driver to bring me. He wanted to take someone else, but he took me. And in the course of the conversation, it turns out he's a Palestinian, Christian Palestinian, and when I told him I was racing because I had a program about Dr. Martin Luther King. He said, "I will get you there. I will get you there. You are a righteous person." And he was like, he wouldn't even take a tip from me. He was like, "You are
beautiful.
Doing important work," you know, etc. It was a beautiful moment, one of those New York
right.
moments that
That's
you don't
great.
Expect.
That's
and he
really
says,
great.
"I have many Jewish friends. Believe me, many of these people are very righteous." You know, I said, okay, I know. So, but I'm just saying it's a way in which we also maybe can break down some of the stereotypes that divide us, and we can find common ground, commonality in our traditions. Here we are remembering Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I was to have had Jesse Jackson, who was in Memphis that day, and I've heard him talk about this many times with us,
right.
but Reverend Jackson is not a man who is, you know, very driven by clocks, okay? All right? So, you know, he's off. He will call me, I'm sure, when the show is over. But
he will call.
But in any event, the point is...
All right, so Danny, picking up the story, the result was I wrote what became called the Freedom Seder. And we did the Freedom Seder. It was published by Ramparts Magazine, the whole other story by itself. And then we actually did the Freedom Seder in the basement of a black church in the heart of Washington on the first anniversary of Dr. King's death, which was the third night of Passover in 1969. And it was incredible. It was hundreds of people, about half of them Jewish, and the other half divided between white and black Christians. So it was an amazing moment. WBAI in New York broadcast it live. It went on for about 3.5 hours. They broadcast it live. The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation broadcast segments of it the next Sunday. And what it did, to my astonishment, this was not what I had in mind, but it was amazing. It liberated the Haggadah. It liberated the Passover Seder. And suddenly people who thought you could only use the Seder if it was the Maxwell House Haggadah, and therefore they got bored and fed up and didn't do it at all, suddenly said, oh, you mean I can write a Seder about women's liberation. I can write a Seder about vegetarianism. I can write a Seder about gay rights. I can write a Seder about the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo in Argentina resisting the military fascist.
And you did, Arthur. And
not
and,
me, people.
No, but you helped spark this, and which is one of the reasons I wanted to have you on today as somebody who also knew Dr. King. We're running a little out of time in this segment.
Okay,
I have to
let me come back to the question you raised. Where
you can
the
do
Jews
it quickly
today.
Yeah.
So actually, for me, the deeper question about King and Heschel is, and for that matter, about the Freedom Seder is, where is the prophetic voice today? And it may be, I think it may importantly be, in the movement around the climate crisis. And in fact, I've been involved with people who brought Palm Sunday and Passover together as a way of confronting the pharaohs and Caesars of our own generation, big oil, big coal, big carbon, and beginning to work on what it means to get not only colleges and universities, which Bill McKibben's been working on, but religious communities to divest their money from big carbons. I'm working on a piece that says, would you invest in Pharaoh and his plagues? You know, what do we do with our money?
Rabbi, just let our listeners know how they can reach you, the Shalom Center Philadelphia.
It's www.theshalomcenter.org. And you can write me at A Wasko, that's AWASKOW at theshalomcenter.org.
Thank you so much for joining us. We could
go on and on.
I'm very pleased that you were able to do this. We're going to have another taste of Nina Simone, and then we'll be back in a minute with more.
Okay, it's Danny, I just.
The mountaintop. And he knew he could not stop. Always living with a threat of death ahead. Folks, you'd better stop and think and feel again. Are we headed for the brink? At one moment that you know what life is, if you have to die, it's all right. He had seen mountaintop, and he knew he could not stop. Always living with a threat.
Nina Simone with that most beautiful song, paying tribute to Martin Luther King. And you know, at a time in our country when he was killed, it certainly was a shock and a trauma. And his absence even to this day, is duly noted and deeply missed by so many people who look to him as a prophetic voice, as a fighter for justice, as a man who transcended his role as a preacher from a small church in Atlanta to becoming the preacher of the Church of America, if you will. And of course, he's now honored on the Mall in Washington with a big statue. I was at the ceremony where all these people came and spoke about him, including President Obama, about Dr. Martin Luther King. But there is a danger that his memory, will be, in a sense, abbreviated to only include his standing as a moral leader, and not as a political voice for justice and against war and for a different type of America. And that's what Dr. King represented so much. And that's why, even to this day, as we think about Dr. King, we have to go beyond the March on Washington, which I was at. We have to go beyond his speech Beyond Vietnam at the Riverside Church and look at this man, his totality, his body of work, his thinking, his charisma, his drive, and his energy, and why he's remembered, not just, by people in our country, but by people all over the world, including the taxi driver who comes from Palestine, who brought me here. So I wanted to go into a little bit of the unanswered questions about Dr. King's death. You know, this is something that haunts me to this day. How was he killed? What do we know? Was it James Earl Ray that did it, or James Earl Ray just pulled the trigger? So Shetterly in Maine has been doing studies of this and has been analyzing all this. Are you with us?
I am.
Good.
Nice to talk with you. Thank you.
Tell us just a little bit about, introduce yourself properly, and tell us a little bit about the work you've done.
Okay. I'm an artist. I live on the coast of Maine. 11 years ago, I, in response to this country being taken into yet another unnecessary and immoral war, the Iraq War, I switched gears with my life. I started painting the series of portraits that I call Americans Who Tell the Truth, which now travel to schools and colleges and museums and libraries all over this country and give me an opportunity to meet with all kinds of people to talk about the professed ideals of this country and where we are in relationship to them and how, in fact, they are one when they're one.
So here's an artist on the coast of Maine, touched by the man who died in Memphis in 1968 and is still honoring his work. But you've done it in a way to raise questions about his death and the unanswered questions, the fact that nobody seems to want to know what happened.
Right. Nobody wants to talk about it. And, strangely, it was actually the King family, Coretta and his children, who were convinced that James Earl Ray was not the killer, that he was merely a patsy. In fact, they may not have even been in town when King was shot. And so they brought a suit in 1999 in Memphis. They were trying to bring it a lot earlier because they actually wanted to clear the name of James Earl Ray before he died in prison, but the process took too long, and they had hired William Pepper, who had been James Earl Ray's lawyer, who was an English lawyer, who had spent many years trying to figure out just what happened there, and they hired Pepper to try to clear the name of James Earl Ray, and when the case finally came to court, in 1999, all the King family was asking was for $100 in recompense and an opportunity to tell the truth, get the truth out there. And they had a jury trial. And Pepper proved in court to the jury with confessions from people in... I mean, by the way, a lot of this information is in a great book written by the lawyer, William Pepper, called An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King, which came out several years ago. And in there are the confessions of people in the Memphis police, the mafia, the FBI, and the special forces of the U.S. Army, all admitting that they were engaged in this assassination.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, that we don't have those details, that people were trying to bring out the truth are treated as if they are like just troublemakers who are provocateurs.
How? Absolutely. I mean, the funny thing about it is, I mean, here, the jury agreed. I mean, they ruled in favor of the King family and William Pepper and awarded the $100. And the media, the major media in this country, just buried it. I mean, they didn't talk about it. I mean, if one's interested in finding out the facts of this trial, you can find them on the Internet. But it's so disturbing, you know, when we honor this man who, as you, when you introduced him, I mean, you said, you know, all these things that are true. I mean, in 1968, I was 20 years old. I had just turned my draft card in, you know, for the Vietnam War as a means of protest, you know, largely persuaded by the moral imperative of Dr. King. And, you know, to have him treated this way now, I mean, you know, I think when you look, I mean, you have to look at why did they want him dead? And I think that's the more interesting things in terms of American history in a way, rather than the fact that he was killed. We kill lots of people, but I mean, he had become far too dangerous to this country, to the power in this country, because he wasn't just talking about civil rights anymore. He was talking about all the other legs that support American power and imperialism and economy. He was talking about militarism and materialism and poverty and racism and how they all work together to produce this vast system of injustice. And
I mean, think about this for just one second. I mean, here's a guy who was, by that time in his life, you know, an established icon and celebrity. Okay, he was loved by millions. He was known globally. He won the Nobel Peace Prize. He was a global figure, and yet he persevered, taking us into some of the, you know, kind of, shall we say, hidden places in our society. He insisted on pursuing lines of inquiry that they didn't want him to pursue, and speaking out about it. I mean, that's a phenomenal, you know, decision that he must have made, and the pressure that he must have been under not to do it. And of course, spied on by the FBI, ridiculed by some, opposed by many, and yet he kept at it, didn't he?
Well, he certainly kept at it, and you know, he kept at it in spite of the fact that many people, leaders in the civil rights movement, were telling him to tone it down, to not talk about the Vietnam War, to not talk about imperialism, you know, to keep it to civil rights. And I think, you know, when we think of his courage, which is astounding, probably the most, to my mind, the most courageous thing he did was to start to make those connections and speak out about them, because he had to go against many people who were supporters of him. But, you know, you say that he was loved by millions, an icon. You also, it's equally true that he was hated, you know, absolutely hated by many people. I mean, when he was killed, I mean, there were also millions of people who cheered. I mean,
Martin Luther Coon is what, yeah, is what the hate group said. And remember, yeah, when he went to Chicago, people threw rocks at him. He was despised, if you
right.
will, for getting outside of the safe role of the Baptist preacher and confronting racism throughout America. You know, not being satisfied with just desegregating lunch counters or public accommodations. I mean, he was a soldier, a drum major is what they call him, you know.
Well, he kept looking for what were the causes, and he wasn't just wanting to treat symptoms. He was realizing that if this country was really going to change, we had to treat the causes that were underneath. That racism wasn't just an attitude of some people. There was a whole system which supported it and promoted it for benefit for other people and accumulation of power. And when he, you know, started to talk about that and get people to understand what he was talking about, he became much more dangerous to, you know, the power structure than he had been earlier on.
You know, it's hard to recognize that given the fact that, you know, he's now, what, the Google Man of the Year. You know, Apple, you know, quotes him. I mean, he's been embraced by every major power center of American life, and he's quoted with great regularity by, you know, presidents and you know, various peons of various kinds. But nevertheless, with a great deal of respect, and yet they only want to see a certain Martin Luther King Jr. They don't want to see, you know, the king that that actually forced us to think about things more deeply and to care about things more deeply.
Absolutely. The iconization of him was also the process by which he was made safe again. He was safe when he was, or relatively safe, when he was a civil rights leader. He was not safe when he really began to attack the power structure. And then he was, after his death, when most people, they now have no idea of the depth of his understanding and critique of this country.
It seems that to really endanger the power structure, you need a single focus on one extraordinary person. I'm wondering if the internet, even though it disperses power much more broadly, it also diffuses power. It seems to be hard to have a single person like that who could arise and capture that many people when there are so many voices out there.
You know,
I think that's true, but I don't know if the fault is the internet. I still think there's an awful lot of problem with the major media. I mean, a great body of people don't really use the internet for research or information. They're still watching TV.
I've been very engaged with South Africa and Nelson Mandela. I've done several films with him, I was in Atlanta when he visited and paid tribute to Dr. King's memorial at the Martin Luther King Center. And when asked about it, he said, listen, nonviolence is a good policy, but it's not always the only policy. He admired Dr. King, but he said, there were certain things that we had to do in our country that was different. Mandela, of course, is a symbol of Kingian proportions today, who's, hopefully will survive this latest medical problem that he has. But, it's not just the one, it's not just one man that makes the show. And this is part of the problem, is that there was a civil rights movement, a movement of millions of people who were actively engaged in this struggle. I was part of the organizing team of the March on Washington. Believe me, we had no idea. We had no idea how many people would turn out. Now, stay with us, because Reverend Jesse Jackson Jr. is joining us. Reverend Jackson, are you there?
Reverend Jackson Sr. is in the house, Danny Schechter.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. This is what you call CT, not CPT, but Chicago time. He's joining us anyway. And we're talking, and we've had a very soulful conversation here for the last 40 minutes about Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. And, of course, you knew him very well, closely. You were in Memphis that day. Tell us a little bit, maybe things we don't know about what was happening then, how you found out about this, and how this changed you and your life.
Well, I was in conversation with him, literally talking with him when he was shot. But it is that was led up to that that has real meaning for us. We had a hurried meeting that Saturday morning before going to Memphis. Said, I need to meet with you. Andy Young was there, James Bevel, Jose Williams, a few of us. He said, for 3 days I've had a migraine headache. I've thought so much about being under such attack and so much perplexity. He said, I even thought about quitting. Maybe I've done as much as I could do in 13 years. We won the Montgomery bus boycott. We have a civil rights bill. We have the right to vote. We're moving to getting open housing, and maybe I've done as much as I can do. He said, if I were to quit now, those who never gave up would not forgive me, so we must go on. Amanda Young saying, Dr. King, don't talk that way. He said, Andy, let me finish. Don't say peace, peace, when there is no peace. And so we all got rather quiet. And he said, I thought maybe there's such division in our ranks today in the civil rights leadership. Division of us, we focus on war in Vietnam and just civil rights at home. He said, and maybe I thought if I would fast the point of death, that my friends would gather by my side, Stokely and Rapp and Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young and others of them, and we could regain our unity. But, you know, we've got to turn the minus into a plus and move on to Memphis and fight for those sanitation workers on the Washington, if necessary, civil disobedience to get the issue from the war on poverty, war in Vietnam to war on poverty. And like he taught them, sent that out of a depression, you know.
Did he
and
have a premonition?
Those three stages that Jesus went through, you know, let this cup pass from me. And as he prayed, disciples slept, and not my will, but thine be done. It was a very kind of spiritual, theological, philosophical, political moment he went through. And we went on to Memphis, and there he was determined, even though that was a saboteur was found on the mind, the march to lift up the camarade of workers and make it a part of the poor people's campaign, ending poverty and ending the war. His last two great missions, ending poverty and ending the war.
You know, in that speech in Memphis, he said, you know, I may not get there with you. Well, mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord, but I may not get there with you. Did he have a premonition somehow?
For a long time I did not want to believe that, Danny, but then on the other hand, one could say when he said, I may not get there with you because it's a long way to get to the promised land. It took us from 68 to 08 to get to the White House. But I thought when he said, I'm not fearing any man, that there's a sense in which he may have known something we did not know about just how intense the death threats have become. After all, getting on the plane in Atlanta, they had to enter the plane for the death threats about doing something to the plane because he was on the plane. So maybe the intensity of the threats made him say, I'm not fearing any man. My eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. So he walked in the valleys and shadows of death, but the problem is being such a courageous, such an intellectually endowed man. Another king was very courageous, and we used to talk about he'd overcome the fear of death. He'd overcome that fear. He said that, and I'd like to have a long life as any man would have raised my children, be with my wife, but nothing would stand between me and the love of God. That was kind of his position. It was not fatalistic. It was just his view of life and death.
Now, that inspired you, Reverend Jackson. You were a young man, younger than you are now. I was, too. You know, in Memphis that day, and yet you persevered. You know, your church, your center, the Rainbow Push, is Dr. King's workshop, is how you describe it. Dr. King has been a very important part of your life and driving you on to serve, you know, people and to represent your vision and your values. Isn't that the case?
Well,
what was it about him?
I think that most people direct programs and try to do good work through good programs. But he was a transformer. He saw the bigger picture. Even we didn't see the bigger picture. I was putting a lot of focus during those times, for example, on Operation Breadbasket, leveraging consumer power for jobs and contracts. He saw that as important, but still very temporary. He saw the bigger picture of wiping out poverty without wiping out the poor and using our resources to end such heavy investment in war and not enough in social justice. So he had this vision of seeing the bigger picture and had gained this credibility across lines. I might say that so many people who loved him as a martyr rejected him as a martyr. He died a very hated man. The man of love died hated. The man of nonviolence died violently.
So he was a drum major, they said, you know, for justice. He was a spark plug that people remember. Why do you think so many years later we're still, you know, in a sense, talking so reverentially and with such great tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King?
I suppose because many of his, the platform was a high platform when he spoke, but also we were bringing down the walls of apartheid and legal segregation, and there was such fear in the land, and the walls were so rigid. I was arrested in 1960 trying to use a public library. We were arrested trying to use theaters. We could only sit on the front of theaters, sit in the balcony of theaters on the weekend. Arrested trying to use, you know, basic public facilities. Black soldiers had to sit behind not the prison of war on the military basis. Against that backdrop, he did hear what Mandela did ultimately in South Africa. He even set the pace what Mandela did in South Africa. So our victory in America laid the groundwork for ending apartheid in South Africa.
And today is April 4th, okay? April 4th, significant.
45 years. It was about this time of day, just a little bit after, maybe 1 minute after 6, about 6 minutes.
And yet a year earlier, April 4th, the same day, he gave his famous Beyond Vietnam speech at the Riverside Church.
And a year to the day. We were coming across the parking lot. I shall not forget. We should mostly talk about his parents and his family lineage. We're just kind of musing and talking and laughing and playing much of that day. And I was coming across the courtyard, and he said, "Jesse, we're late." And I said, "Doctor, sure, what is he here? But you don't have on a tie. We're going to Reverend Kyle's home to eat." The doctor, prerequisite for eating is an epitaph, not a tie. He said, "You are crazy." And we laughed about it. He leaned over and said to Ben Branch, "Be sure to play my favorite song, Precious Lord, tonight." And as he finished, and he raised, I said, "Doc." And I said, "Doc."
Is that what you called him, Doc?
Yeah. The bullet hit him in the neck and severed his necktie and went down and blew his heart out. He died instantly. That was a tough one, even 45 years later, to think about it. And I remember someone saying, get low, because whoever was shooting, if they had been shooting multiple shots, it killed several of us in the parking lot. Ran up to the balcony, and there he was with his foot up on the banister of the balcony.
Do you ever forget that level of trauma, observing and witnessing something like that that was so tragic and terrible for our country and for somebody who you admired and worked with so closely?
Well, I try not to think about it. I mean, frankly, if it had been anybody you see shot that way, you would not forget it. But of course, especially him, because the world will not let you forget April 4th, 1960, 45 years ago. In many ways, life is but one after Martin Luther King Jr., Danny.
For the 40 years
of the day, we went from the balcony of Memphis to the balcony of the White House after 40 years in the wilderness of much, much, much struggle.
I don't want to trivialize this, but just to end on an up moment, if you will, he had a good sense of humor, didn't he, Dr. King? That side of him wasn't well known. He observed things closely.
Well, that was not for, you know, news coverage, but he was a funny guy, you know, because he was a guy of the people. I mean, what he was shooting pool to make guys feel a comfort level, laughing with other medicines and playing practical jokes and throwing pillows. We had lots of fun, you know. We had lots of fun, but the moments of agony and joy stick with me the most.
Well, you know, of all the people who were involved that day, you know, many aren't with us anymore, but you've persevered. You've continued, in a sense, to serve the struggle that you were part of as a young man, and something that I admire a tremendous amount in you, your global awareness and your concern about the poor and your concern about, you know, right and wrong and trying to fight for
right. You know, the irony, I'm going to Kenya next week. Kenyatta, the son of Jomo Kenyatta, has been elected president of Kenya. Yeah. We're going to be a part of the inauguration, so the burning tree is on. Become the president of Kenya on this coming Tuesday. So those who laid the groundwork, the Burning Spears, the Kenyattas, and the Mandelas, and Dr. Kings, those who brought down those barriers live on.
Well, Reverend Jackson, thank you so much for joining us here in the end of this program. You made a very significant input. I'm sorry, Mr. Shetterly, an artist from Maine who's been with us, that we had to give the airwaves over to Reverend Jackson, but I think it was really important and worthwhile. Thank you for being with us earlier, Rabbi Arthur Waskow, who is part of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party delegation in Atlantic City, was with us as well. So we want to remember Dr. King and pay tribute to the fight. We're still fighting the fight to do right. And thank you so much for being here. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. If you want to write to me, you can write to dissector@mediachannel.org. And you can listen to this program again in the archives at prn.fm. It'll be on my blog tomorrow at newsdissector.net. I'm also now editing the new mediachannel.org. So please come and join us on that as well. Thank you for being with us.